Good morning, everybody. Last week, we gathered together and looked at the story of Joseph when he was in the pit of prison. As I listened to that song, I wonder, maybe I'm projecting back on Joseph, but did he sing songs like that in the middle of prison? Be thou my vision, O Lord of my heart. Don't be anything else to me but what you are. This week, we're going to find out what happened to Joseph. Since last week, we've spent a week reminding ourselves of God's people suffering, and that even in suffering, we can continue to have faith and we can continue to love others. We also spent time this week lamenting the suffering that happens to us individually, to us as a people, and the suffering that happens because of the society that we live in. Today, we're going to discover what happened to Joseph next. So let me tell you where we're going to go today. We're going to look at the structure of the book really quickly. Then we're going to listen to the chapter together and then take a tour of Genesis 41. At the end, we're going to review a couple of big ideas and give ourselves some questions to work through this week in shepherding groups or in our families or with our friends. Here is the structure of the book. And for those of you who were here last week, you're going to see that it's really almost identical to last week. The chapters read the same. So at the beginning of the chapter, in verse 1, we see that time passes. In verses 2 and following, we see that Pharaoh dreams two dreams. In verse 8, we find out that there's no one who can interpret the dreams. In verse 16, once again, Joseph steps up and says that God will interpret the dreams. In verses 17 and following, Pharaoh tells his dreams. In verse 25, Joseph interprets the dreams. In verse 33, once again, Joseph inserts a plan. And in verses 53 and 54, we see that the interpretation proves true. And in verse 57, we see the result of all of this. Now, even more than last week, I'm going to ask you to use this structure as you listen to the chapter as a coat hook. If you remember last week, you're going to get a lot of details. Chapter 41 is significantly longer than chapter 40. So you have a lot to listen and remember. So let's use this structure to try to remember these things. Let's listen together and remember that these are God's words for us. Those are God's words. Let me insert one thing for you who've been around through the Genesis series, and maybe if you're visiting today, you wonder why we would take 7 minutes and 25 seconds to listen to the entire chapter of Genesis 41. We receive instructions in the New Testament for us to give attention to the public reading of Scripture when we gather. So we feel that this is also a way for us to both honor God's word and obey what He wants us to do together. These are God's words. And even these strange stories with strange dreams, we're praying that God will use for us. This week, let's start with the big ideas. Big idea number one, God keeps His promise and saves the world in an unexpected way. God keeps His promise and saves the world in an unexpected way. Big idea number two, Joseph's story only makes sense in the context of God's story. Joseph's story only makes sense in the context of God's story. So, for the rest of our time together, I want you to think of me as a tour guide through the book, the chapter of Genesis 41. I'm going to be pointing out various sites that lead us to our big ideas. I actually thought of trying to find one of those tour guide outfits with the khaki shorts and knee socks and ranger hat, but thought that might be pushing the envelope a little bit just for an illustration. But the tour guide idea is the best way that I can hem myself in. There's so much that we could talk about. It's like visiting the Capitol in Washington, D.C. and going on the tour. You hear a whole lot about the Capitol in Washington, D.C. on the tour, but there are so many other stories and details and things that you could talk about. So if I think of myself as a tour guide in the book, I'll lead us to the end, to the big ideas, and maybe not get lost in so many details. As I walked through this chapter, I saw four stops on the tour. The first one is Pharaoh's dreams, then the cupbearer's memory, Joseph's journey, and God's promise. So let's begin by looking at Pharaoh's dreams. 2 whole years have passed, and once again, we begin with this idea of dreams. God enters into culture to accomplish his means through dreams and their interpretations. These dreams are a bit more disturbing than last week's dreams. Last week, if you remember, the baker and cupbearer had their dreams about normal baker-cupbearer things. This week, Pharaoh has a dream and then recounts it and describes it as uglier than anything he's ever seen in Egypt. The author is really specific that there are two dreams. We see Pharaoh have a dream, awake, go back to sleep, have another dream. And Pharaoh's dreams are odd. They're about cannibal cows and grain-on-grain violence. These odd images of unattractive, disease-ridden cows consuming other cows. And Pharaoh adds the comment that they didn't even look better after eating. No sustenance after they ate the healthy cows. So see this moment where you have Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, a guy who in this culture is esteemed as a god, wakes up worried. Imagine being on that staff, the workers of Pharaoh, when the guy you think is a god wakes up worried about his dream. If your religion is based on that type of man, maybe you should rethink that. Because if the God is troubled by his own dreams, then that's a problem. When Pharaoh awoke, he called every magician and wise man he could to try to help him interpret the dreams. Remember last week, the cupbearer and baker, they didn't have access to someone to help them understand their dreams. But now you have Pharaoh who has access to everybody, every wise man and magician, and yet he arrives at the same place as the cupbearer and baker. There's no information. So either all these guys that he called couldn't interpret it, or Pharaoh just didn't like what they were saying. So with all of Egypt's wisdom, Pharaoh was still stumped. The next sight we see on the tour of Genesis 41 is the cupbearer's memory. Finally, he remembers. He finally remembers Joseph, the Hebrew guy in prison who got him out of prison. Every time I get to this point in the story, I feel like looking at the guy and saying, "It's about time, you jerk. You should have remembered this 2 years ago and let the guy get out of prison." But this situation where his boss, where Pharaoh is in a panic, clicks a memory. And he starts telling Pharaoh about what happened. This sudden return of memory is enough to cause Pharaoh to declare an immediate release order for Joseph. So now, action just starts happening. This is where we begin Joseph's journey. Now, often when you're on a tour, there are some places that you have to stop longer than others because of the amount of detail. And that's where we are with Joseph's journey. We're going to spend most of our time looking at how Joseph went from the pit to the presidency. Joseph's journey begins very abruptly. The text tells us they quickly brought him out of the pit. The word there has a really broad range of meaning. It can mean to run, to dart about, and to chase. So as you think about the story and read the story, it's not slow moving. Pharaoh's worried. Pharaoh's in a panic. He snaps his fingers and guards run to the prison and grab a hold of Joseph and yank him out of prison. Now, remember where Joseph was. He was in the pit. We described that last week as a dried out septic tank. So a stop at the showers on the way is a priority. It's a good idea for him to stop and shave. But even in that moment, there's more going on. The Egyptians, as a culture, didn't wear facial hair, and they shaved their heads. So Joseph is now being made Egyptian. He shows up before Pharaoh as an Egyptian slave with an Egyptian hairstyle and Egyptian clothes. As Pastor R. Kent Hughes describes, Joseph is being Egyptianized. Pharaoh tells Joseph that he needs his help with some dream interpretation. Now, if we were wondering about Joseph's spiritual state after being stuck in prison for 2 whole years, we immediately discover where he is in the story. Pharaoh asks this slave brought out of prison for help, and the first thing that Joseph does, the first words out of his mouth to Pharaoh are to exclude himself from being able to help Pharaoh. It's an odd choice of words, at least as I read it. Like if this is a time where I get to talk to Pharaoh, the first thing Joseph says is, the answers aren't in me. The answers are apart from me. That not in me is just 2 words. He looks at Pharaoh and says, not me. And then Joseph's intentional focus on God begins for the rest of this story. He tells Pharaoh, God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer. The faith that we saw in Joseph 2 years ago is still there. He's held on to it. Joseph uses a Hebrew word that many of you will be familiar with. You might have heard the word shalom. God will give to Pharaoh a favorable, a peaceful answer. The ruler of Egypt will receive from the God of the universe a peaceful answer. Joseph continues his focus on God. You can see it in the following statements. In verse 25, Joseph said, God has revealed to Pharaoh. In verse 28, Joseph says, it is as I told Pharaoh. God has shown to Pharaoh what he is about to do. And verse 32, he says, the thing is fixed by God, and God will shortly bring it about. What an amazing young man this guy had to have been. That phrase, when we go all the way back to Genesis 39, where we see that God was with Joseph, even when he was in prison, God and Joseph, if I can put it really modern and bluntly, God and Joseph seem to have hung out in prison for years. And his faith was intact. Joseph's journey contains a scene where, yet again, Joseph uses his brain. I love the transition that happens in verse 33. So Joseph has just completed his interpretation of the cannibal cow dreams and tells Pharaoh about 7 years of plenty and 7 years of famine. Now, listen to what he says next to Pharaoh, and remember the scene. Pharaoh's in a panic. All of his servants are probably in a panic now too. They don't know what's going to happen to their country. So Joseph decides this is the time for him to tell Pharaoh what to do. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't think slaves typically offer national advice to rulers just off the cuff. But Joseph steps right in and says this, now therefore let Pharaoh select a discerning and wise man and set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh proceed to appoint overseers over the land and take 1/5 of the produce of the land of Egypt during the 7 plentiful years. Let them gather all the food of these good years that are coming and store up grain under the authority of Pharaoh for food in the cities, and let them keep it. The food shall be a reserve for the land against the 7 years of famine that are to occur in the land of Egypt, so that the land may not perish through famine. Now, I reminded you last week that I often look through these stories and narrative from my theatrical background. Do you see what Joseph is doing? Like Joseph realizes at this point that no other wise men have been able to help Pharaoh. Joseph then interprets the dream and then throws in a plan. And in my brain, I kind of hear Joseph saying, well, it sure would be great if we could find a discerning and wise guy who might be able to come up with an idea to save your country. Maybe we should develop a famine response committee. Maybe we should figure out how to keep all of this grain. And I love the way that guy thinks. Like in that moment, he's been released. God gave him the dream, but he goes right in and gives this off-the-cuff plan. the slave. The slave comes up with an unexpected plan to save the entire country. Joseph takes another step in his journey when he's exalted over all of Egypt. Pharaoh is so enthralled with Joseph's plan that he immediately hires him as his vice president. Joseph has all the power in Egypt. The text uses the illustration that no one in Egypt was allowed to lift their hand or their foot without Joseph saying, "Lift your hand or foot." That is a lot of power. This is the point in the movie version of Joseph's life that we all get excited. Like and they're doing all types of Bible movies right now. If Joseph is the next character, and they've already done a couple of animated versions, but if they do a live version, this appears to be the place where they could culminate it. Finally, he's the hero. Finally, his fortune has been reversed. He gets his due, if you will. This has to be the pinnacle of the story, right? When he gets out of prison and now he has everything. This is the point where he can, you know, if you want to make everything resolve, this is whenever you see the camera shot of Joseph walking by Potiphar and Potiphar's wife. That would have been an interesting interaction, wouldn't it? Is it the pinnacle? Let's stay on the tour and find out. Pharaoh once again seems to be working really hard to Egyptianize Joseph. Joseph is given Egyptian symbols of power, more Egyptian clothing. Pharaoh decides that Joseph's name is either too Hebrew or too associated with a slave, and so he renames him an Egyptian name, Zaphnath-Paneah. He then takes Zaph on a parade in his second chariot and tells someone to get in front and tell everybody to bow to Joseph. Now remember the culture. Joseph is a very high ruler. This isn't just a parade of respect. This could be placing Joseph in a position to believe that he deserves to be worshipped. That's a lot of pressure. Could you imagine in one moment going from where any of us are financially to the ability to tell everybody in this room whether or not they're allowed to lift their hand or foot? So much pressure on Joseph. In a bold move, Pharaoh takes that even further and decides that Joseph needs to marry an Egyptian wife. And so Asenath is presented to Joseph as his wife, and Joseph really did not have much of a choice. Arranged marriages were culturally common, but this one presented for Joseph some really interesting familial relations. Joseph's father-in-law was a priest in the city of On, the sun city. His father-in-law ran the temple for Ra. How would you like to have seen those holiday get-togethers? What would Joseph do in that reality, that situation? Although Joseph has been exalted to a very powerful position, I believe the text reveals he is still not free. He's now in the service of Pharaoh and does not even have the freedom to choose his own bride. Of course, his circumstances are different, but the temptations may be the same. In the pit, Joseph may have been tempted to forget God because of the sorrow. In the presidency, Joseph may have been tempted to forget God because of the success. Joseph's exalted position was a vocation. It was not his salvation. Joseph's faith in God proves that Joseph saw his salvation as Yahweh, his salvation as God. So we're going to jump forward a little bit in the story, in Joseph's journey, and see, did Joseph preserve his identity? Did Joseph remain who he was, a Hebrew, one of God's people? We know the time frame of this chapter lasts anywhere from 2 to 7 years. We know that because Joseph has 2 kids, and then the famine hits. So somewhere in the 7 years of plenty, Joseph and Asenath have a family of their own. and Joseph's kids are evidence that Joseph kept his identity even with all the pressure of becoming Egyptian, becoming different, believing in his success, believing in his power. He maintained who he was. Joseph named his kids Hebrew names rather than Egyptian names. By their names, we can see Joseph was orienting them towards his God. Joseph himself was still oriented toward the God of his fathers. The names of the children are really important because they provide us the best glimpse into how Joseph thought about himself. If you remember last week, a lot of what I shared, I said it might have been. The story, the narrative allows us to ask questions. But here, with the names of Joseph's kids, we get the most insight into what Joseph was actually thinking. Joseph's first boy is named Manasseh. And Joseph tells us this name was chosen because God has made me forget all my hardship and all my father's house. Joseph could be as old as 35 years old at this point in the story. Joseph was probably 17 when his brothers threw him into the pit and sold him into slavery. 18 years later, Joseph is honest about life. Joseph describes his life as one of hardship, that is, toil, labor, and trouble. Joseph attributes to God a heavenly forgetfulness. Joseph forgot his hardship in all of his father's house. Imagine being Joseph for those 18 years and wrestling with your feelings about your family. How many times did Joseph weep over the hatred of his brothers? How many times did Joseph long to just sit down at dinner with his dad? Here, the middle-aged Joseph is able to declare that God has gifted him with the power to forget. Joseph's second boy is named Ephraim. Joseph tells us this name is because God made me fruitful in the land of affliction. Once again, Joseph is honest about where he is. Even though he's the second most powerful man in the entire country, Joseph describes his geography as a land of affliction. Egypt has not been kind to Joseph. Yet there's also a confession of another of God's gifts to Joseph. God allowed Joseph to be fruitful even in the land of affliction. We can see this as we chart his story. Wherever Joseph went, God made him fruitful, and his fruitfulness blessed those around him. Joseph shares his testimony with us by naming his boys forgetful and fruitful, to remind us and to remind him of the power of his God in the midst of hardship and affliction. Our final stop on the tour of Genesis 41 takes us to the end of the chapter, where right in front of our eyes, we see God keep his promise to Joseph's great-granddad. So Joseph's dad is Jacob. Jacob's dad's Isaac. Isaac's dad is Abraham. We met Abraham in Genesis chapter 12. In Genesis chapter 12, God and Abraham have a conversation. And in that conversation, God says this to Abraham. Abraham, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. And I will make of you a great nation. And I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. And him who dishonors you, I will curse. And in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Now let's look at the end of Genesis 41. So, when the famine had spread over all the land, Joseph opened all the storehouses and sold to the Egyptians, for the famine was severe in the land of Egypt. Moreover, all the earth came to Egypt to Joseph to buy grain because the famine was severe over all the earth. A few moments ago, I described Joseph receiving his promotion as the highlight in the movie version of his life. That's the point where he gets all the stuff. But the real highlight of the story is right here. Because now we see why Joseph has been exalted. Why is Joseph in this position? Joseph is part of saving the entire world. Joseph is part of God keeping a promise that extends to all peoples, countries, and nationalities. Joseph is an instrument that God uses to save the world and keep his promise in an unexpected way. Yes, we see Joseph resurrected from the pit, and that's awesome, but he was exalted, he was brought up, and God prepared him so that he could basically resurrect the rest of the world from the death of famine. The world could have remained in famine, but through Joseph, God's servant, the promise of God extended to anyone who needed bread. The storehouses of Egypt contained the bread of life that the people in Egypt, Israel, and the world needed to survive. In coming to Egypt, the world came to Joseph, and through Joseph, God saved the world. In a way, without Joseph, there's no Jesus. Because the world would not have been maintained. So, the official tour of Genesis 41 is over. But like any good tour guide, I'm not finished. At the end of a tour, typically this is the point where the guy tries to get you to go buy a souvenir in the gift shop or put a tip in the glass jar. I will do neither, since neither are really appropriate for a sermon. But I do want you to walk away with something. I want you to have something in your hands. And that's, I want to review these two big ideas and see, does the chapter lead to these ideas? Big idea one, God keeps his promise and saves the world in an unexpected way. Who saw the end of this story coming? I guarantee you that morning that neither Pharaoh, the magicians, the wise men, the jailers, the soldiers, any of those guys thought, oh, the way this is going to go about is Joseph's going to tell the dream and then he's going to be promoted to the vice presidency and he'll come up with a brilliant plan on the spot to save enough grain to save Egypt and the entire world. We see God often do this in the scriptures, that through unexpected ways, he accomplishes his purpose. God is allowing us to peek through the window and see him keep his promise, to see his faithfulness in an unlikely hero in an unlikely way. I believe this chapter also allows us to look forward to a time and see God continue to fulfill his promise. The starvation and hunger continue, but now the need isn't necessarily physical, but spiritual. At one point in Jesus' life, he did this miracle where he fed thousands of people with very little bread. It was an amazing moment where God's power was displayed. After he did that, Jesus went away for a time, and his disciples followed him. And when they caught up to Jesus, Jesus said to them, "You're following me because of the physical miracle I did. I created bread. But you need better bread than that. You need a bread that lasts forever." And his disciples were like, "That's a great idea. We want that bread." And Jesus' response was brilliant. "I am the bread of life. I am the bread that you need." Just like the Egyptians ran to Joseph for physical bread to sustain their lives, so we must run to Jesus and consume a bread that will never let us starve. In many ways, God used Joseph to be the savior of the Egyptian race and the world at that time. Joseph provided grain for bread. Likewise, God provided Jesus to be the Savior of the world. God provided in Jesus a bread that completely satisfies and completely saves. We're going through this book of Genesis believing that the story it tells us is that we're separated from God. From the beginning, we rebelled against God and we're separated from Him. But in this same story, we see that God makes a big promise. He's going to redeem. He's going to buy back His people. There's no behavior, no rule keeping. There's nothing we can do to close that gap. This blessing, this promise is extended to all people through Jesus, through the bread of life. The question to ask is, have I experienced this promise? One of the things that we've learned about our gathering together as a people is the range of people coming to this gathering is pretty wide. So we want you to know, we don't assume that everyone here is a Christ follower, that you've experienced this promise, but we really want you to. So if you have questions about this, I know making connections from Genesis to Jesus to you, that's a journey. But if you have questions about this, after we're done, come down and talk to us. There'll be some of us down here just sitting, and we'd love to talk to you. My hope is that if you sense you've never been satisfied in that way with a relationship with Jesus, that maybe today is the day you experience the bread of life. Big idea number two, Joseph's story only makes sense in the context of God's story. Now, we've reviewed at length and multiple times the events of Joseph's life last week and this week. They definitely weren't easy for Joseph, and they're really not even easy for us to hear. Unlike Joseph, we have the advantage of holding Genesis 41 in our hand. We can flip the page and see what happens next. Joseph lived a life convinced of the reality of his God, convinced of the reality of God's faithfulness, even when circumstance would tempt him to alter that view. Like when those 2 years began, Joseph was at a crossroad of whether or not he was going to believe that his story was still part of God's story, even though he was in prison. And it seems that Joseph continued to believe that he knew he fit into what God was doing. Joseph was able to see God at work even when circumstances stunk. A couple of guys are thrown in prison and they need help. Joseph saw God at work. Pharaoh needed a dream interpreted. Joseph saw God at work. Joseph and Asenath have kids, and Joseph sees God at work. This can be a great challenge for us, right? Do you see God at work when you're in the pit? Do you see yourself in God's story in those moments? It's easier to see us in the story when it resolves and it's made right. But do you know how to read your story, what's going on in your world in light of who God is and His story? How do we do that? How can other people help us do that? And so I would love for you to take that to your shepherding groups and to your homes and to your friends and ask each other those types of questions. Like, do you see yourself right now in light of what God's doing? Remember, God's keeping a big promise and He's doing it in unexpected ways. He did it through a slave whose family hated him. What's He doing in you? So let me end with two questions that come out of this chapter that I really want us to deal with. And they're both based on these big ideas being true. If it's true that God will keep His promise and save the world in an unexpected way, and if it's true that Joseph's story and our story only make sense in the context of God's story, then question number one is this: will I forget my hardship and be fruitful in affliction? I didn't want to ignore this part of the story. And my primary motivation for that is I just thought through hurting people hearing the story of Joseph and then Joseph making this statement that I have forgotten all my hardship and all my father's house. And wondering if anybody would hear that and say and ask the question, well, why can't I? Joseph declares through Manasseh's name that he has forgotten his hardship and his father's house. What does that mean? Joseph is revealing something very significant about his mindset. He has released his past from determining his identity. This doesn't mean he literally has no memory or he literally doesn't remember, because he named his kid Forgetful. So every time he sees Forgetful, he's going to be thinking about his past and his hardship. But in seeing that boy and seeing Manasseh run around, Joseph is preaching to himself, that is not what is going to define me. I'm sure he would always have memories of looking up at his brothers who threw him into the pit. I'm sure he remembered many nights that he spent in prison. However, Joseph is declaring through his boy, those events will not define me. I believe we see in Joseph a faith in God that affects the way he thinks about his past. Also, it's really important to notice that Joseph being able to make that declaration took time. From the time of his hardship when he was sold until he makes the declaration is anywhere between 13 and 18 years. Joseph processed his life before God for 13 to 18 years and then made this declaration. Joseph arrived at the conclusion by looking back. Sometimes we can gain a perspective by looking back and through God's help achieve a forgetfulness of what has happened. Let me say one more thing on this forgetfulness thing. The advice of looking at somebody and saying, well, just forgive and forget, is really not helpful. To just tell somebody to do that. Forgiving and forgetting are acts of the will. So we see God tell us that because of Jesus, he will remember our sins and iniquities no more. That doesn't mean God has amnesia. That means that God is looking at Jesus and removing, not remembering, not counting our sins against us. So for us, the idea of forgiving and forgetting are those same thing. Joseph is setting a pattern of his life that I will forget every time I look at Manasseh. So, for us, when it comes to being forgetful about our hardship and fruitful in a place where we've been hurt, what would it look like for us to pray for heavenly forgetfulness? What hardship seeks to define who you are? What is that thing in life that's holding on to you that wants to tell you this is who you are? I believe that God's people, because of God's faithfulness and love to us, through time can have a heavenly forgetfulness. Question number two that arises out of the idea of God saving the world and keeping his promise in an unexpected way and our story fitting into God's story. The question is this: how can I live in and bless my culture? And man, I wish we could spend like forever here. When I first wrote out the notes for today, I thought about including just a big text box at the end of your notes that says, these are the other four sermons I wish I could have preached out of this chapter. And this application is one of those. Like, you look at Joseph and the way he lived, and he raises some huge questions for us. Like, this is a guy who was kidnapped, who was stolen, who was sold into slavery. God's blessing on him, he purposely blessed other people. in a really pagan place. Joseph was an island of faith in Egypt, more than likely. And yet, because of who he was, because he was God's people, that flowed out and blessed others. I've thought of those moments. Again, he married Asenath. What would it have been like for Joseph early in marriage when he woke up and Asenath was worshiping the sun? How did he bless and live in that moment? How did he operate as a politician in the midst of that culture as one of God's people? And I believe these are questions that we can wrestle with. I've provided you some examples that I would love for you to work through, to look at. It's interesting, all the examples I've given you, all three of these people were victims of kidnapping and slavery who blessed their culture. So one of those stories is in 2 Kings, where we see a little girl who was kidnapped in battle bless a family that she served. I'd love for you to read the book of Daniel and compare Daniel and Joseph. How did they live in culture? What did they do? How did they serve those around them? What qualities did they share? What positions are you in that reflect that tension of being one of God's people in a pagan culture? And how do you bless those around you? What would that look like in your neighborhood? What would that look like in your business? And for many of us, what would that look like on sports teams? God is keeping his promise to his people and saving the world in an unexpected way and allowing us to see that our life, whatever's going on in your life, whether you're in the pit or you're president, either one of those only makes sense in the context of who God is and what he's doing. May God allow us to see ourselves in light of his story. And may we participate in his mission to save the world. And may we bless those that live around us right here in Greenville, Greer, Taylor's, Traveler's Rest, all those little cities. May the steadfast love of God be with us and bless those around us, just like Joseph.